The voice of John L. Lewis.
The United Mine Workers of America are instructed to resume immediately the mining and production of coal to continue until midnight, Wednesday, November 30, 1949.
The National Broadcasting Company's News and Special Events Department brings you Voices and Events, the living record of history this week. You'll hear President Truman, Senator Herbert Lehman and Mayor O'Dwyer, Vito Marcantonio and Alvin Barkley, and a special report on John L. Lewis, the actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. Now, here is your editor for Voices and Events, James Fleming.
Election night, 1949. The results greeted by Democrats with cheers. And perhaps for the first time in history, we heard a president of the United States reading the returns.
Some late returns. In Boston, Mayor Curley has 15,427 votes and Hines has 14,948. In New York, Mayor O'Dwyer has 406,000 votes and Newbold Morris 291,000. The latest of turns on the Lehman Dulles fiasco is... It will be that when Lehman gets through with this fellow. In New York, Lehman took a lead over Dulles in 1,452 precincts. He's 393,092 to 317,307. If you come in, we'll try to give them to you.
President Truman was speaking off the cuff to the National Women's Democratic Club. The results were all but final, and Mr. Truman acknowledged the ladies' role in what was happening in New York State.
I'm very certain that every woman in the great state of New York has been doing her duty today as a result of those returns. That means she's had the old man go to the polls and she's gone herself and voted. I'd say there are about 2% more women vote than the men. And if we don't look out... If we don't look out, we'll probably have a feminine government someday. I don't think the country would be any worse off, do you?
Yes, it was all over 2 hours after the polls closed here in New York. Republican newspapers were conceding early to Democrat Herbert Lehman, and it came time for the senator-elect to acknowledge his victory.
At this moment of victory, I feel a deep sense of humility and a profound gratitude. With the struggle over, I shall take my seat in the United States Senate as the representative of all the people of our state.
At the headquarters of John Foster Dulles, they put away the makings of a victory celebration, but the man who'd been appointed to the Senate by Governor Dewey and withdrawn by vote of the people mustered a cheer from his campaign workers when he said,
"We've had a good fight, and I believe that the results of this election show that the principle for which we have fought will and must prevail. I thank you all."
Newsmen at the Greenwich Village headquarters of Vito Marcantonio found only the younger enthusiasts of the American Labor Party talking in terms of victory when the polls closed. The veteran strategists of the left wing were more interested in the size of the vote that could be rolled up in Marcantonio's bid to become mayor. Ben Davis, the only elected communist official in the nation, had been turned out as a New York City councilman by the voters of Harlem. It was a bad night for the far left, as Marcantonio announced the results of the city election to his solemn followers.
Friends, the final figures from police headquarters are as follows. O'Dwyer, 1,264,600. Morris, 956,170. And my figure is 356,323. We have lost an election, but we have not lost the fight.
There were many who had given the nod to Newbold Morris in the closing days of the campaign, his bitter attack on Tammany Hall, his support by almost all New York City newspapers, and the Republican, Liberal, and Fusion parties made him the best bet for beating Mayor William O'Dwyer. You could hear the disappointment in his voice as Newbold Morris conceded defeat.
I've given my heart and soul to this campaign. And all I can say is to those who believe in the cause of good government, it's worth fighting for, even if you don't make it.
No, this was not an election where the candidates showered each other with good wishes and sporting words. The bitterness lingered on, and even in victory, Bill O'Dwyer blasted his opponents.
Ladies and gentlemen, the votes have been counted, and I have the honor, with my running mates, to be reelected for another term. Neither the bilge, the filth, nor the newspapers were able to fool or change the minds of the people. I do hope the babies that ran against us will learn that in the next 4 years, and someday they might get off their ice skates and be he-men.
All along the line, it was a Democratic victory, except in New Jersey, where liberal Republican Governor Alfred Driscoll won out over Democrat Elmer Wien, who had the backing of the once powerful boss Frank Haig. Some Republicans found cheer in the New Jersey results. Others were inclined to brush off the entire election. Perhaps it was Harold Stassen who spoke for most Republicans when he talked of the meaning of the election results.
Our Republican Party in America is in a bad way. You know it's in a bad way. I know it's in a bad way. The people know it's in a bad way. Unless the party serves the opposition to the gravy train approach, unless it takes a firm position in opposition to the Truman domestic program, then there is no real service that the party can give.
To understand Stassen, you had to know, is he still a GOP presidential candidate? And if so, what about those two formidable opponents in that contest, Governor Dewey and General Eisenhower? At Washington's National Press Club, they asked whether the election results meant the end of Dewey as a candidate.
Do the results of the New York State election eliminate Dewey from the national picture? Well, I would say that no individual election ever completely eliminates anyone. Sometimes they have a marked trend in that direction.
This question has a hidden premise. It is, do you consider General Eisenhower your chief opponent in the 1952?
Do you consider General Eisenhower your chief opponent for the 1952 Republican nomination? That is what I call a loaded double-barreled question. This is a question that I hope you ask me 2 years from now if you decide to invite me back again.
Meanwhile, jubilant Democrats agreed with the analysis by President Truman. The sort of an election as we had this week took on added meaning, or so said Mr. Truman.
When we win that sort of a victory in a year such as this, we assume a much greater responsibility from now on than we've had in the past year. But the Democratic platform set out certain things which it is our duty to try to accomplish. And I want to say to you that the first session of the 81st Congress did a remarkable job. And the second session of the 81st Congress is going to do a better job as a result of these elections today. And I'm more than convinced that the Democratic Party, the party of the people, will continue to do that job for the welfare of this nation and for the welfare of the world.
No little part of the American political scene is its humor. And there was time for that, too, this week when politics were in the minds of many.
Let's call it the commentator's revenge. Remember that time a year ago, just after the 1948 elections, when President Truman spoke to the Electoral College and gave that memorable imitation of NBC's H.V. Kaltenbrunner? Well, now, on the NBC television program Who Said That?, the Dean of Commentators replied in kind. Let's recall both moments and listen first to President Truman as he spoke to the Electoral College.
I had my sandwich and glass of buttermilk and went to bed at 6:30. And along about 12 o'clock, I happened to wake up for some reason, and the radio was turned on the National Broadcasting Company. And Mr. Kelsenborn... and Mr. Hartness were reporting the situation as it then developed. And Mr. Kelsenborn was saying, "Well, the president is a million votes ahead in the popular vote we have yet to get." And we are very sure that when the country vote comes in, Mr. Truman will be defeated by an overwhelming majority. And then Mr. Harkness came on and he analyzed the situation as Mr. Kelsenborn had reported it. And to the sorrow of myself and those of who were listening with me, it looked very much as if the election would be thrown into the House of Representatives because it was not possible for me to get a majority of the electoral votes of the nation. And I went back to bed and went to sleep.
Well, next, how it happened on Who Said That? Robert Trout was asking the questions when suddenly guest expert Oscar Levant threw a challenge at H.V. Kaltenborn. If Mr. Truman imitated you, how about your playing the Missouri Waltz on the piano?
I'll agree to imitate Harry Truman playing the Missouri Waltz with one finger, provided you take up the lower part of the keyboard and with your great skillful emendations cover up my mistakes. Okay? Oh, yo, give me a hand.
No, you do it alone. Truman would resent my help.
You do it alone. May I first familiarize myself with this keyboard?
Yes, Mr. Kaltenborn, you may.
It is a bad piano.
Yes, if presidents can imitate commentators, surely they can play the piano like presidents.
You are listening to Voices and Events, the living record of history compiled by NBC's News and Special Events Department, the actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. Now, from the NBC Newsroom in New York, here again is James Fleming.
On this 42nd day of the most costly and staggering steel strike in history, it's virtually all over. From Pittsburgh last night came word that the CIO steelworkers and United States Steel have reached agreement on pensions. Big Inland Steel was quick to follow. Fewer than 100,000 men are idle this day. These are the employees of a few holdout companies. Hear the story now from reporter Jack Swift at station KDKA Pittsburgh.
Eagerly, steel workers are trooping back to the plants, ready to make vital steel once again. Most of them have only two paydays before Christmas, each payday for 2 weeks only, 2 weeks' pay held back. That is, if a man went back to work today, he still wouldn't receive a paycheck until December 10th, then another December 23rd. And after 42 days of idleness, they're broke. But at least they're back at work, and the kiddies will have some sort of Christmas.
Yes, it's not a story told alone in dollars and tons. There's a human side, too, and you can see it in the sprawling plants of Big Steel, soon to be roaring back to life.
Just the other day, I walked the streets of Homestead. It was a ghost town. Last night, when the news of the strike settlement arrived, women ran to front porches and shouted the news to neighbors. Small fires were lighted with picket signs as fuel. It was the same in other U.S. steel towns. Only about 100,000 men remained out on strike. They're employed by the few holdout companies still to sign up, and these holdouts are expected to fall in line in just a few days. This is Jack Swift in Pittsburgh.
Crowding the news of cold wars and hot elections this week was the continuing story of a nation, an industry, and a man. America, coal, and John Llewellyn Lewis.
John L. Lewis is a legend born of a time and an industry that's left an unhealing scar on the United States. This week, Voices and Events looks back through the years for the changing story of John L. Lewis told in his own words. Lewis, the militant leader of labor. Lewis, the canny politician who considers himself victim of a great betrayal. Let's begin by listening to an almost forgotten John L., to Lewis as he entered the national political scene during the Depression and turned his mighty wrath and scorn against Herbert Hoover.
One authoritative governmental agency reported to Mr. Hoover that 5 million babies were undernourished and suffering from malnutrition. Mr. Hoover took no action. No doubt he believed that assistance to babies would undermine their initiative.
Hope was reborn in a foundering nation as the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt took over. Lewis cast his lot with Roosevelt personally and financially, and his majestic voice was raised in the next campaign in behalf of the Democrats and against Republican Alf Landon.
You have heard his voice as he halts and stumbles over the most simple phrases of our common tongue. Betimes you have listened to the broadcasting of his diurnal and nocturnal babblements, as with quibble and quirk, he seeks to cozen the American people.
Knowing what came after in Lewis's political fortunes, it sounds strange to hear them again, these words from the past.
An American concerned with the future will vote for the re-election of Roosevelt.
The year 1936, out of the mighty struggle of working men to better their conditions, had come the American Federation of Labor, and now something new, something untried, something radical, industrial unionism, and the Committee on Industrial Organization, the CIO. That year, John L. Lewis, as head of the young CIO, spoke like this.
The Committee for Industrial Organization is carrying its plans forward. The year 1936 has witnessed the beginning of this great movement in the mass production industries. The year 1937 will witness an unparalleled growth in the numerical strength of labor in the heretofore unorganized industries.
1937 was to see a new and violent innovation in the labor movement, the sit-down strike, which beat the auto industry. Chicago police shot strikers in the back as they picketed outside Republic Steel in what was to be known as the Memorial Day Massacre. This was the time of Roosevelt's one-third of a nation speech, and John L. Lewis was feeling his own political strength. He looked about at the great mass of farmers and thought of his catch-all District 50 of the mine workers as a vehicle for a farm workers' organization. As he spoke to the nation then, he saw ominous signs in the condition of our country.
Our farmers and our unemployed have been patient. Why they have been so patient during these years of anguish is beyond understanding. But their patience is not inexhaustible. Beyond patience lies despair. And from despair springs action, drastic and unpredictable.
The sit-down strike in General Motors ended in victory for the Union, and the final break between Lewis and Roosevelt. In the campaign of 1940, the United Mine Workers of America were in convention in Columbus, Ohio. Lewis delivered his first personal attack on the Democratic Party like this.
Labor today has no point of contact with the Democratic administration and power, except for casual and occasional interviews which are granted its individual leaders.
The year of 1940 was only a few weeks old at that time, but in the next few months, Lewis sharpened his attack with a bitter personal blast at Roosevelt. Perhaps you recall this angry speech.
The president has said that he hates war and will work for peace, but his acts do not match his words. The foregoing statement constitutes the first basis of my personal opposition to the re-election of President Roosevelt for a third term as chief executive of the Republic. America needs no Superman. It denies the philosophy that runs to the deification of the state. America wants no royal family.
Yes, final attempts at reconciliation had failed. This week, a longtime confidant of Lewis, Saul Alinsky, wrote the story of a dramatic interview between the two giants in which Lewis accused Roosevelt of tapping his telephone and angrily refused his support. This was the campaign of 1940, and 8 days after the White House meeting, the nation listened to these then strange words from John L. Lewis.
If not Roosevelt, whom do I recommend to do the job of making secure our nation and its people? Why, of course, I recommend the election of Wendell L. Wilkie as the next president of the United States.
Those were the words that hurt and shocked Union men everywhere. And those were the words that foreshadowed Lewis's break with the CIO. Throughout his ups and downs in industrial unionism, John L. Lewis did not lose the support of his fanatically devoted miners, the coal diggers he'd led from the serfdom of company towns to high earnings and self-respect. John L. Lewis spoke with feeling as he addressed the convention of his mine workers in 1941.
The United Mine Workers of America is a human institution. But with all of its errors and mistakes of judgment, in the years of its history, the United Mine Workers of America points to a proud record of accomplishment.
The pattern of the next few years was to see Lewis back in the fold of the AF&L and out again with the coming of the Taft-Hartley Law. Once more, the single-minded figure of rage and emotion who can so dominate the American economy. This week, the strike of his miners was called off, but with words that gave little promise of permanent peace in the coal fields.
As an act of good faith designed to contribute to public convenience, the United Mine Workers of America will again make another contribution of major magnitude to enhance the remote possibility of agreement being reached. Resolve that the members of the United Mine Workers of America in all bituminous coal districts east of the Mississippi River are instructed to resume immediately the mining and production of coal to continue until midnight, Wednesday, November 30, 1949.
Week's end finds Lewis in New York saying he's willing to negotiate again, but the strike threat still stands. In his own way, in his own time, John L. Lewis will act just as he's always done.
Washington insiders had known for some time that a change was due in the president's cabinet. It happened this week when Julius Krug bowed out as Secretary of the Interior.
It wasn't altogether with good feeling that Krug quit the Truman High Command. Some said the president was displeased at his announcing his resignation first to the press. Well, whatever the reason, the administration moved up to the cabinet post the Undersecretary of the Interior, career man Oscar Chapman.
I'm deeply interested in conservation, the development of the West, and those things that go to make up the real development of our country. Conservation of natural resources to me are translated into the terms of conservation of human resources.
It was hard to tell this week who in public life was making more headlines with romance, New York's Mayor O'Dwyer or Vice President Barkley.
Well, out in Chicago, the Veep won a new honor, Grandfather of the Year, a selection made, appropriately enough, by an organization of grandmothers. NBC reporter Len O'Connor found out all about this when he talked with this lady.
I'm the president of the grandmothers, have been for 8 years.
Would you tell me a little bit about the grandmothers?
Well, the grandmothers are the most unique organization you ever met. We have the most wonderful people in the world are members of the grandmothers club.
Undoubtedly.
We were born only 11 years ago, and now our membership in the city of Chicago alone stands at over 1,000 members. and our meetings are really something to behold. Then we have our own Gay 90s show. We do 10 shows a month before Legion posts and churches and PTAs and all of that sort of thing. We have 24 different numbers in our show, and it really is a whiz of a show, believe it or not. All grandmothers.
How are you inspired? The vice president, the grandfather of the year.
Well, we decided the grandfather had been left at the fireside for so long, you know, and what's good for the goose ought to be good for the gander. And we decided we'd sort of inject a little new life into those fellows.
Well, Mr. Barkley accepted the honor with grace and good humor, and then faced the inevitable questions about his forthcoming marriage to that attractive St. Louis widow, Mrs. Carlton Hadley. Len O'Connor had interviewed the Veep on this subject before the announcement of the engagement, so he recalled...
The last time we talked with him, the question of how he'd make out in his romance with Mrs. Hadley was a matter of national concern. The engagement is now a definite thing. Even so, we mentioned to Mr. Barkley that the last time we talked with him...
You were still in doubt as to whether you would make the grade, and... And talking to you now, I certainly would like to ask you or say that we'd like to congratulate you on behalf of our own audience and all the people who were pulling for you, as you said.
Well, I appreciate that very much. I did express some concern at that time as to whether I was making the grade or would make it, but I appreciated also that millions of people were pulling for me. Their pulling seems to have been effective. We have set the date on which I hope to make the grade and to consummate the whole thing.
Armistice Day this year, as it has every year, finds the people of the earth still groping for the way to permanent peace.
And perhaps time this week to look back to the very first armistice. One newsman who was there for that original ceremony is NBC's Earl Godwin.
Harding was president. His words on that day gave rise to a real belief that eternal peace would settle upon the world. Standing in the Arlington Amphitheater, Harding called the great nations of the world to a conference to reduce arms and naval armaments everywhere. It was 1921, and no radio networks. I recall the beautiful last scene of that day, a full-blooded Sioux Indian in colorful feathered dress laying his pipe of peace upon the catafalque.
And now for the story of Armistice Day this year, we call on reporter Robert McCormick.
President Truman led the country, the world, in commemorating Armistice Day. He went to Arlington Cemetery across the Potomac from Washington to honor that symbol of all America's war dead, the tomb of the unknown soldier. After a moment of silence, at 1 minute after 11, he stepped forward, gently placed a wreath of chrysanthemums on the simple marble tomb. Across the nation, Defense Secretary Johnson said weakness breeds war. Army Secretary Gray estimated the last war will cost $1 trillion. Air Secretary Symington spoke of the cost in men, and then that final haunting salute to those who have died that we might live, the sounding of taps.
From the NBC newsroom in New York, you have heard Voices and Events, the living dramatic record of history this week compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department. You've heard the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Your editor has been James Fleming. This is Robert Warren speaking and inviting you to listen next week at this same time for Voices and Events.
There's a brand new $26,000 jackpot on Hollywood Calling tomorrow on NBC. And tomorrow, film stars Victor Mature and Linda Darnell will join Jack McCoy in telephone calls to every part of the nation to find a winner for tomorrow's new jackpot. Don't miss the glamour of Hollywood and your chance to win $26,000 in prizes on Hollywood Calling tomorrow on NBC. You're tuned for the stars on NBC.